Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with talks underway as lawmakers meet to fund the rest of fiscal 2014 through September and look for ways around the sequester to mitigate more deep cuts coming in mid-January. Scott Klinger, the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Centre for Effective Government, joins us to discuss the effects of cuts so far and the impact of much more to come. Then, with billionaire Bill Gross of PIMCO calling on his fellow one percenters to pay more taxes to spur economic growth and help those who use their hands for a living, we will examine the growing disparity in wealth in America with Harvard researcher Michael Norton, a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, who has studied the reasons why most Americans are unaware of how wide the income gap is. And when told how much more of the nation's wealth is going to the top, rich and poor alike agree it is unfair and un-American, but then disagree on how to address the problem. Then finally, we'll examine the role of Rafael Cruz, the director of the Purifying Fire Ministry, who recently campaigned with his son, Senator Ted Cruz, in Iowa. Best-selling author Frank Schaefer, whose parents Francis and Edith were the founders of what has become the Christian right, joins us to discuss the Christian Reconstruction Dominionist movement, which seeks to rule America according to biblical law, and Pastor Cruz's remarks that Obama is an outright Marxist who should be sent back to Kenya, and his belief that the United States is a Christian nation formed to honor the Word of God. Joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And lawmakers met on Wednesday, and they'll meet again in a couple of weeks to figure out how to mitigate the effects of the next round of sequester cuts due in mid-January and to deal with the current ones. And what's your sense, though? Because you have a division here. The Senate wants to get rid of the sequester altogether, but the House has decided this is a great way to cut government spending except for defense.
Right. Well, you may remember that the sequester started in 2011 when we had an impasse similar to the one we just went through. And it was set in place as something that no one thought would ever happen. It was so draconian and so bad that they put it in place to make sure the super committee would find an agreement on the budget. And when they didn't, starting in March, the sequester went into effect. It's basically spending cuts on autopilot. They're indiscriminate. They cut both the domestic side of the budget and the military side evenly. At least they were supposed to. The military side got a bit of a reprieve last year when they put off $20 billion of military cuts in 2013, and those are supposed to be catch up on in this current year. But basically, the sequester is really hurting jobs, and Congressional Budget Office estimated that somewhere between 300,000 and 1.6 million jobs could be added if we got rid of the sequester. And so, you know, I think many Americans are really thinking we have a jobs crisis, not much less of a deficit crisis than we used to have.
Well, we demonstrably don't have a deficit crisis because the deficit is going down at record speed.
That's right. It's fallen more than in half since 2009 when President Obama came to office, and it was down over $400 billion last year alone.
So is this economic illiteracy on the part of the conservatives in the House with their obsession over deficits, or are deficits a stalking horse for their real obsession and their real goal, which is to cut the taxes on the rich? Because it doesn't make any sense when an economy is barely recovering to throw a lot of people out of work.
Well, you know, it doesn't make any sense, and it's really hurting America's competitiveness in the world. We find that we're less competitive in terms of having an educated workforce. We're much less competitive in terms of the research and development that we're able to do. Our country used to lead the world in research and development. We're rapidly falling behind. investing in research is a way to create new jobs. We think of all the things from life-saving drugs to technology to internet. All have roots in federally funded either university contracts or government-funded labs. So we're really cutting ourselves short by focusing only on the math and not on the people. Government should be about people and about making sure we all have an opportunity for a dignified and successful life. And when we have these automatic cuts, we're not paying attention to those priorities.
So is anybody listening to the director of the National Institute of Health who's saying that, you know, that we're cutting programs that might have the next breakthrough to cure cancer, or we're firing investigators who could be tomorrow's Nobel Prize winners? I mean, and when you've got the director of the FBI basically saying that, you know, they can't operate with this huge cut that they've gone through, an $800 million cut, and now they're going to have an even, I think it's almost twice it, isn't it, coming up?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, all these agencies, including one that, you know, we're trained not to like in terms of the IRS, but they're cutting enforcement officers, and they're doing far less audits than they used to, primarily of rich people and of corporations. And every dollar they spend on auditing, they get at least $6 back in added revenue. So, you know, there's just really nonsensical, non-business-like approaches to this when we just put the government on autopilot and don't think about what we want to invest in and the kind of country we want to have.
And, of course, in a curious and ironic way, we kind of breathed a sigh of relief after the closure of the government ended and the threat to tank the economy ended recently. But we went back to this terrible situation, right? The sequester.
Well, we think of the sequester as a rolling shutdown. You know, if people remember there were furloughs of government workers all throughout last year. That's going to continue for the next 9 years. Unless we do something about that, and government offices closed when people need those services. So it's really, you know, a trickle of the shutdown that we had in a big way earlier this month. We're going to see that on a rolling basis going forward.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shares Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. So who's meeting in these panels of lawmakers that are trying to figure out a way around the sequester and a way to avoid these even more draconian cuts coming in mid-January?
Well, there's 29 members of the House and Senate, and it's heavily weighted towards senators. But it looks like the hard negotiations, are going to be done largely by Senator Patty Murray and Congressman Paul Ryan, the heads of each of their chambers' budget committees. And that's caused some consternation among some of the conference members in terms of not wanting, you know, to just have a two-person deal negotiated out of the public eye. And we have concerns about that as well. So the next time we'll hear something should be right before Thanksgiving. They hope to have some sort of plan, or at least basis of agreement that they can move a budget forward. And then after that, I think the plan is to send it back to the appropriations committees, where they'll come up with specific spending targets for each function of the government, probably by the end of the year if they're able to.
So there's no way to do a reality check on asking the principal and most important question is, why are we doing this in the first place? Because conditions have changed, right? We don't have a budget crisis. We have an employment crisis. Furthermore, we have an income distribution crisis, and we have a crisis in a failing middle class, not to mention a stressed-out working class.
And a failure to invest adequately to ensure a bright future for our country and our economy.
So it's almost like the lawmakers are on autopilot as much as the sequester itself is cuts by autopilot.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they're preoccupied by other agendas, and they're not paying attention to the people's business.
So what's your sense then of given that you say that this panel of lawmakers that are negotiating weighted heavily in the Senate's favor, they think this thing's a mistake in the first place. Where does the White House stand?
Well, the White House is I think, one of the big question marks where they stand. They have not been as supportive of new revenue as we would hope they would in terms of closing offshore tax loopholes and some of the other major giveaways that are in the tax code. One thing I just recently learned is that we spend money both through allowing corporations and wealthy people not to pay taxes by giving them tax credits and tax loopholes. So we spend money on the tax side of the budget, and we also spend money on the spending side, where the government writes checks to operate programs. And those two ways we spend money are pretty equal. In fact, we spend more money by giving tax breaks and tax loopholes than we do on all the programs that we associate with the federal government that are not the entitlement programs, the discretionary programs. So we really think we need to look at cutting spending on the tax expenditure side of the budget. We hope that's what the Senate stands for. We think they do. And we'll see where the White House falls out in that.
But if the House members of this panel are weighted in favor of relieving the Pentagon of the cuts, the automatic cuts in the sequester, and then piling them back on to the domestic side of the budget, what's the prognosis there?
That's one of the worst outcomes that we can have, I think, that A, it sets a really bad precedent for the future, and B, it doesn't meet the basic needs and needs to invest that we have that are going on right now. So exactly what you described, replacing the defense cuts with more cuts on the social side and domestic side is probably one of the worst outcomes that can come out of this process.
But we've already had an indication that that's what's happened already, right? Didn't you say that they spared $20 billion of the Pentagon's cuts?
Yeah, so they got a special deal last year, and they were supposed to make up that $20 billion this year. So in part, the lines coming out of Congress are, well, look, the defense is getting cut so much more this year than the other side of the budget. Well, that's because they got a $20 billion break last year that they didn't have to come up with.
Well, obviously, the whole sequester could be solved if they canceled the useless F-35 fighter program, fighter bomber, everything. You know, it's an all-in-one plane that doesn't do anything very particularly well. And it is the biggest weapon system in history, and it's a complete turkey.
Doesn't work, right? Yeah.
I mean, if you got rid of that, you'd probably take care of the entire sequester, wouldn't you?
At least several years of it. And there's a number of things like that. Another one is closing the offshore tax loopholes, which raises about $220 billion over 10 years. So there's certainly a number of things that could be done that would harm very few people. It might harm some moneyed interests and some defense contractors, but the average American would not be worse off for making some of these changes. But I think part of the problem, Ian, is that we are stuck on thinking we still need to cut. And as you said earlier, the budget deficit's come way down. It's scarcely a problem, and yet we continue to have the conversations around, well, how can we replace the cuts with other cuts? And we think we really need to shift the conversation to think about what kind of country we want, what do we need to invest in, what kind of research do we need, what infrastructure do we need to fix, how can we help our kids in school, both in elementary school and high school, and also afford college. These are the questions that aren't getting asked that are being subsumed to the conversation about austerity, and that's what we need to change.
Well, just before you go, Scott Klinger, I'd like to get you to comment on Bill Gross of PIMCO has put on his website he's obviously got a lot of people that follow him. He's considered a kind of guru. He's the bond king. And he says, a fair economic system should always allow for an opportunity to succeed. Congratulations. Smoke that cigar. Enjoy that Chateau Lafite 1989. But most of you guys should acknowledge your good fortune at having been born in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, entering the male-dominated workforce 25 years later, and having had the privilege of riding a credit wave and a credit boom for the past three decades. You did not, as President Obama averred, build that. You did not create that wave, you rode it. And now it's time to kick out and share some of your good fortune by paying higher taxes or reforming them to favor economic growth and labor, as opposed to corporate profits and individual gazillions.
You know, I really celebrate the statement by Bill Gross, and I think what's most important is that we all tell ourselves a story about who we are and how we've gotten where we are. And for him to acknowledge that, you know, it's not all about him, that he had support from society, he had the luck of being born at a good time, he had all the privileges of being white and male and American in this world, and he understands that he owes something back, and I think we need a lot more people like Bill Gross.
And do you think that there is a chance that, I mean, if you got the, in terms of sequester, you got the head of the FBI saying this is a catastrophe, nobody seems to be listening to him. Are anybody listening to that Bill Gross is in the, and the Warren Buffetts amongst the hedge funds, billionaires, and the those that only pay 15% tax?
Well, you know, when they get organized, I think they provide an interesting voice, especially in Congress. One of my previous jobs was working as the co-director of Responsible Wealth, where we organized millionaires and billionaires to keep the estate tax. And, you know, people listened to them. And I think, you know, the estate tax has been decimated quite a bit from what it used to be, but we still have it. And I think it's in part because the people who would pay it stood up and said it's a fair tax, it's a good tax, and we should keep it. People like Bill Gates' dad and George Soros and Warren Buffett and many others. So I think what Bill Gross is doing is important. I hope other people rally around him and say, yeah, I agree with Bill. And maybe we'll see a movement of the one percenters for economic justice. That'd be a nice thing to see.
Well, we're going to continue the conversation on income disparity in this country. So I thank you very much, Scott Klinger, for joining us here.
It's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Klinger, who is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He's a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as Tax Policy Director for Business for Shared Prosperity and as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a researcher who's done an analysis on why people in America don't believe the income gap is as wide as it is and that all the wealth is going to the top.